This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear issued an executive order on Thursday. It makes face masks mandatory in most public areas and businesses, particularly where social distancing cannot be maintained. It goes into effect at 5 p.m. and it lasts for 30 days. Ohio, meanwhile, is taking a more targeted approach to its mask mandate. But Governor Mike DeWine's administration just added another local county to that list. So joining us to talk about it, our Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief, Karen Kassler. Karen, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us. And we also have with us on the phone Cincinnati Inquirer State Government Reporter Jesse Balmer. Jesse, thank you for being back with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Questions, comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email your questions to talk@wvxu.org. I want to start with this comment on the way Ohio is handling its mask mandate. It's from Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper. He's been quite critical of the way the governor is going about this. He says, quote, "It's rare that I'd say this, but if only Ohio would follow the political leaders of Kentucky and West Virginia, we'd be doing better." He goes on to say, no joke, Ohio is literally waiting for counties to hit level red and then requiring that folks wear their mask. I can think of no human enterprise where such a reactive approach makes sense. Pepper goes on to say, but in a pandemic, such a passive approach will cost lives, health, and jobs. Karen, let's start with you. Can you just explain what this color-coded map means and the way that the governor is going about his mask mandate?
Yeah, if you want to see the map for yourself, you can go to coronavirus.ohio.gov, and it's there under a section labeled Public Health Alerts, I think it is. I'm trying to pull it up right now to see. But what the whole map was intended to do was to give people an idea of how the virus is spreading in individual counties. It's the Ohio Public Health Advisory System. And you know, as we were all talking about mask mandates, the governor's been asked several times about mandating masks statewide. Other states, other surrounding states have done this. When this color-coded map started to surface, it looked like this was the way that he was going to try to find what he has called a surgical approach to dealing with the virus in different counties, because it is affecting different counties in different ways. And so this map shows everything from a level one, which is a public emergency, active exposure and spread. The entire state is at least in a level one. Then there's level two, level three, and level four. Level four, nobody's hit level four yet. That's severe exposure and spread. Only leave home for supplies and services. So basically kind of like the shutdown orders, the stay-at-home orders that were issued back in March. This right now, the mask mandate that's in place right now for 12 Ohio counties is just designed to try to alert people to that there is spread, that it's happening, and that people should be wearing masks according to the best science that we have that states that mask wearing does help with the spread. And of these 12 counties, three of them, Cuyahoga and also Butler and Hamilton counties, are on a watch list, meaning they could move up to that higher purple level if indeed case numbers don't fall and other indicators that the state is watching to see how fast the virus is spreading.
Well, that's got to be concerning for folks here, because I think people had grown quite restless with the shutdown, but there's been that fear that perhaps this could happen. What metrics are they looking at before they reach the conclusion that those counties are now a public emergency level four?
There are a whole list of indicators. They include things like cases and hospitalizations and where people are getting the virus. Is it in a congregate setting? Is it somewhere else? And I believe the governor said that to reach the level of purple, it'd be like at least six indicators. It's a complicated set of data, but it's trying to really zone in on how the virus is spreading and not just looking at things like how many people in a county have it. Because certainly in more populous counties like Hamilton County, you're going to have more cases because you have more people. How can the state really, at least according to this, track what's happening and try to stop the spread and remind people that this is not over, that even though the stay-at-home order expired, the ban on large gatherings continues, and other states are really experiencing some dramatic increases, and including having situations where they're running out of ICU beds, and that's what the state has been trying to avoid all along.
Jesse Balmer is with the Cincinnati Inquirer and joins us on the phone. Jesse, in your reporting on this issue, you note that Butler County has seen an increase in the number of people in emergency room beds. It's increased from 2 people a week to 7 people a week. You write that it's not a large number in a county of more than 380,000, but what did the governor have to say about that?
Yeah, his response was essentially, you need to be looking at the trend here. So 2 per day to 7 per day doesn't seem like a massive number, but when you compare it, you know, it's obviously a dramatic increase. Another one of the indicators that really tipped Southwest Ohio into these more serious categories was intensive care unit bed occupancy. And the indicator is basically if ICU bed occupancy capacity is above 80% for 3 of the last 7 days. And in Southwest Ohio regional hospitals total, it was over 80% for 5 of the last 7 days. And I think the health collaborative had it at 88% yesterday. So to Karen's point, they're looking at, you know, are there going to be enough beds for people who are sick? And that's something they want to keep a close eye on.
And Jesse, go ahead, Karen. Oh, yes.
I just want to add one thing. You know, when you start talking about small numbers of cases, but then they're increasing, when you start doing the math and you start talking about exponential increases potentially, that's when it really gets scary. When you think about how long it was not that long ago that we had no cases in Ohio. And here we are 4 months in and we have 57,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, 2,700 people who have died of COVID-19 just in Ohio, just since the first death was March 20th. That's the kind of thing, as Jesse's talking about, the trends that the state is saying to watch for, because those numbers may not stay low forever, especially if they are exponentially increasing. They're going to get big really fast.
And Jesse, talking more about this color-coded map that lists the level of public emergency 1 through 4 for the various counties across the state, we saw Hamilton and Butler, Montgomery placed there pretty early in Southwest Ohio, but already within the same week, it looks like Claremont has been added. So how frequently do we expect the governor to come out and update the situation in each place?
Yeah, so this map is going to be updated once a week. It's going to be updated on Thursdays, so that's something people can watch for. Initially, there were 7 different counties that were at this red level, which is the level where they're going to require most people to wear a face covering or a mask, and that took effect on Wednesday, and then they came out yesterday with a new map. There are now 12 counties. One county dropped down in northern Ohio, but there were several new counties, including Claremont, and then those counties residents will be required to wear masks starting at 6 p.m. today.
And we're talking with Karen Kassler from Ohio Public Radio and Jesse Baumert from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Karen, I want to talk about the testing situation in the state. I know that you reported this week that the governor suggested that testing will continue at nursing homes, which have been particularly hit hard, but without National Guard help. What's the story about?
Well, the National Guard has been helping with the pandemic, various pandemic-related missions since March. The first one was to help with food banks that were initially quite overwhelmed with not only the number of people seeking food, but also the loss of elderly volunteers, corporate volunteers, because everybody was shutting down. And so the National Guard came in and helped with the distribution and facilitating what was happening at food banks. They went on and started constructing facilities that would help at hospitals in case hospitals were overrun. They were helping with medical missions in prisons. And one of the big things that they've been doing lately is going into nursing homes and testing staff and residents at nursing homes, because the nursing home numbers are really bad. 76% of all confirmed deaths in Ohio appear to be in nursing homes. And so how do you try to stop what's happening in nursing homes? Because obviously nursing home residents aren't leaving and they don't have visitors. The only people that they're having regular contact with who are leaving are staff members. And so the National Guard have been coming in and doing some testing with them and trying to get a sense of how the spread was in Ohio's nursing homes. But the problem is the federal funding to allow for these pandemic-related missions runs out on August 7th. And I asked the governor this week, what's going to happen once that federal funding runs out, and you won't be able to use the National Guard personnel in this way to do this testing. And not only at nursing homes, but also these pop-up testing sites. There was one in the Cincinnati area this past week. And the governor says he's hoping that funding doesn't run out. If it does run out, then, as he said, we'll have to talk about it. But it really takes away a tool that the state had been using to try to plug some of these gaps here and try to move forward, especially in the testing area, in nursing homes and at these pop-up sites.
And 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us. We do have a caller on the line we'd like to get to. Jack, what's your question or comment?
Yeah, hey, listen, thanks for taking my call. And, you know, I appreciate, you know, what everybody's trying to do. And, we're trying to maintain our safety and this and that. But I don't know. I just feel like it's an overreach by the government. I feel like there's a little fear-mongering going on. And, we have such a thing called statistics. And I've listened and tried to read up on the statistics. And I understand that here in the state of Ohio, we have 11 million people. Then in that 11 million people, we have approximately 50,000 hospital beds. And right now, to date, I understand there's only 892 people that's in a hospital bed that has the coronavirus. And to me, that just doesn't seem like, quote unquote, a pandemic.
Okay, Jack, we appreciate you listening, and thank you so much for giving us a call and sharing your perspective with us. And again, we're talking with Karen Kassler from Ohio Public Radio and Jesse Balmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer. And certainly questions have
been... Can I just say something really quick here?
Yes.
I mean, the medical experts are saying this is a pandemic, and the science is saying that this is a pandemic. We have 2,700 people in Ohio who were alive on March 20th, who are not now, and COVID-19, a positive test for COVID-19 was determined. So the idea that there isn't, that this is not a big deal, is a very big deal to the people, those people and their families and others who are affected by not only that, but the 57,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. And in other states, you have hospitals that are being overrun. People, the hospitals are running out of ICU beds because of what's happening here. And so there's this idea that it's not real, that it's not a pandemic. It is. I mean, that's what the CDC is saying. That's what the science is saying.
And what I wanted to raise here, based on the call from Jack, but also because this is what's been covered this week, a state representative got a lot of national attention about a comment that he made about testing. So it's not just calls into radio programs or posts on social media. You have people in positions of authority who are questioning the processes by which the government is responding to this, which may not be so helpful. Jesse, can you tell us a little bit about this lawmaker and what he said?
Yeah, so there's a representative who represents kind of northeast of the Dayton area named Rep. Nino. And he has been critical of Governor Mike DeWine and the former Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton for quite some time. But after the information about the mask requirements and suggestions came out, he posted on Facebook that you should stop getting tested, basically saying that, you know, we don't want to live in a dictatorship. And it kind of the step is, if you don't get tested, then we won't know there are more cases. And if we don't know there's more cases, then we won't be taking actions to require masks and so forth. And really, like all best scientific practices, not just for COVID, but for really any disease, is to test people, trace the people that they've been in contact with, and then isolate those people who've been infected. And if you kind of follow that model, then you can have things like businesses open and restaurants open because you are isolating the sick individuals. So testing is a key component of that, and something that Governor Mike DeWine, also a Republican, has, you know, really hammered home that it's important to get tested, especially if you're symptomatic. But even those who aren't symptomatic, if you are working in a nursing home, or even like, you know, the football players are being tested and they might be asymptomatic as well. So there are certain cases where you would want to get tested.
And Karen, we talked with Representative Bill Seitz earlier this week on this program about mask, and he's not necessarily anti-mask. He does seem a little soft on it. These are Republicans we're talking about. The governor is also a Republican. How is this playing out within the party?
Well, I mean, right now the legislature is kind of on an Independence Day break. The House isn't scheduled to come back until September. The Senate is supposed to come back once a month throughout the rest of the year. I have an interview next week with Speaker Larry Householder, and I'm really interested to ask him some of these questions. I mean, he's been doing press conferences with reporters after session. He has not been wearing a mask. He at one point said he didn't own one. There are some members of his caucus, a small minority in his caucus, such as Representative Nino Vitale, who have been very vocal about their opposition to masks, to testing, to the shutdowns. And some of them have made the claim that certainly the shutdowns have been a problem for the state's economy. And that's been seen. I mean, when you see 1.4 million jobless claims have been filed in the last 16 weeks. Obviously, these shutdowns have had a tremendous effect. But then the other side of that is you have major colleges and universities canceling workouts, shutting down fall seasons. The Big Ten may actually not play this year. We may not have Ohio State football. The last official announcement for the Big Ten was that there would be no out-of-conference games. I mean, you've got Major League Baseball, you've got the NBA, all of these professional athletic organizations having their players test positive. This is something that's affecting everybody in some respect. And I think there are a lot of people who don't know anybody who's died of COVID-19, don't know anybody who's tested positive, because testing is really still difficult to get in many parts of the state. But it is something that the science is showing is continuing to spread. And so the folks in the legislature who have been pushing back really are in the minority. All Democrats that I've seen have been wearing masks and keeping social distance. And that was a big deal because Representative Stephanie House, the head of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, announced this week that she tested positive for COVID-19. Many Republicans are wearing masks and keeping social distance. So it's this minority that's getting a lot of attention with claims that really don't have any foundation in science.
And we'll get a couple more calls in. We'll go to Brian now. Hi, Brian. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I actually wanted to comment about the previous caller who cited his statistics that only 800 or so people were currently in hospital beds. I think we really need to keep an idea about where good sources are for information. I question where he got his statistics, and that a lot of people are picking things up from memes and things that are on Facebook and not actually looking to the CDC and to scientists and to people who are actually giving us good medical information, and instead propagating some myth that this is not a big deal. I don't remember in my lifetime, I'm 40-some years old, of ever having a pandemic in the United States. This is a big deal.
Brian, thank you so much for the call and sharing your perspective with us. Go ahead, Karen.
I'd like to add in, one of the places that you can find information is this coronavirus.ohio.gov website that the state set up. And there is a section of the website that lists the number of patients who are in the hospital, who are in ICU beds and are on ventilators, who are just COVID-19, confirmed COVID-19 patients. And right now, 905 people are confirmed COVID-19 patients in hospitals right now. But remember, that's not everybody. The hospitals also have to treat non-COVID-19 things like car accidents and people having babies and, you know, all the things that hospitals do. And so they can't be overrun with COVID-19 patients and still provide all those other services. That's been the concern all along about flattening the curve, is making sure that hospitals do have the resources to do what they do on a daily basis, as well as to treat people who are battling an illness, again, that has killed 2,700 Ohioans since March 20th.
Let's go to Bernadine now. Hi, Bernadine. What's your question or comment?
Well, this is my comment for the guy that said he was basing what he thought on statistics. I've had, at graduate level statistics, I've had two statistics courses at Xavier. And the first thing every statistics teacher says the first day of every class, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And this is very well known for people that do research. And you need to have where the statistics were attained, you know, who did the research, who did they ask, what did they, you have to analyze and a transgression analysis is extremely important in statistics, and I think this is what has been done with these statistics because it's so important. So that's all I wanted to say, and thank you guys. I love you guys.
Thank you, Bernadine. We appreciate you so much for listening and for calling and sharing your perspective with us. Time for one more quick call. Let's go to Macy. Hi, Macy. What's your question or comment?
Lacey is the name. It just adds on to what the last caller said. I'm a retired statistician, quantitative analysis, and I think what's being forgotten is that as statisticians, when we do algorithms and different models, we utilize different factors. So you have lower numbers right now because certain factors have been worked in as far as math. If you were to take off these factors and not have complete freedom, you would have skyrocketing statistics. And that's the point. Anyway.
Lacey, I apologize for misspeaking on your name, but thank you so much for calling and sharing your perspective with us. We do appreciate it. Thank you, Lacey. And also thank you, Karen Kassler from Ohio Public Radio and Jesse Ballmer from the Cincinnati Inquirer. We so appreciate your reporting and your willingness to come on and expand upon it on this program so frequently, especially today. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, and I'm sorry to monopolize the conversation for Jesse. She hardly got a word in edgewise because of me, so I'm sorry.
Oh, no apology needed at all. I think that we all have a lot to say right now and a lot to listen to, so thanks to both of you very much.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend.
You too. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Associated Press reported Friday, quote, "The U.S. Roman Catholic Church used a special and unprecedented exemption from federal rules to amass at least $1.4 billion in taxpayer-backed coronavirus aid, with many millions going to dioceses that have paid huge settlements or sought bankruptcy protection because of clergy sexual abuse cover-ups. Some local religious organizations were also recipients of federal support during the pandemic economic response by the federal government." And Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Dan Horn joins us on the phone. Dan, thank you for coming back on.
No, thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you found as it relates to religious organizations in our area and those federal loans that came out.
Yeah, so we took a look at all the congressional districts in our area because that's how a lot of this is organized in the Small Business Administration records, and looked at primarily nonprofits, and then after going through the nonprofits, looked at how many of those were religious organizations, because I had written about this a few months ago when this was exemption was made for them because they typically had not been eligible to receive this money from the SBA and these types of loans. So it turned out there were, by our count, at least $179 million in those three congressional districts in Southern Ohio and Northern Kentucky that went to religious organizations. Some of the numbers range from, $150,000 to $350,000. Some received between $5 million and $10 million. So, it's a wide range. We don't know precise amounts that each of these groups received yet because the SBA has not made that public. But we do know from the range that they provided that number approaches at least $179 million.
Now, these organizations tend to be tax exempt, right?
Correct. Yeah, they would all be tax exempt if they're religious organizations.
And so what was the mechanism that they were able to use in order to be eligible for this? Or was it just written into the bill?
It was just written into the bill. Typically, these SBA loans that are provided, sometimes during emergencies, sometimes, for other circumstances, but they typically do not allow religious organizations to participate. In this case, there was an exception made because the argument was that if, they're being affected by the pandemic and the shutdown that followed in the same way that any other business would be affected. Some of those are government-imposed shutdowns, and so the argument was made that they should be treated no different than anyone else just because they're a religious organization. So the door was open to that. It was unprecedented. That had never happened before. And that money could be used because it is for paycheck protection. That's the name of the program. That money could be spent on the salaries of clergy, priests, rabbis, imams, you name it. And that had never happened before. So it is unprecedented. And that's why we wanted to take a close look at where that money was going.
I quoted earlier in this segment as we were beginning, Dan, this story from the AP that came out on Friday morning. The headline reads, "After lobbying, Catholic Church won $1.4 billion in virus aid." If you're on Twitter right now, Catholic Church is in the top trends. I think it's drawn a lot of conversation. But I happened to notice a tweet from a priest, not sure of his location, but he noted that this was the Paycheck Protection Program. And just like you said, this money was designed across the country to keep people employed. And your reporting notes that the Diocese of Covington, for example, was approved for up to $10 million, which it said was needed to preserve about 500 jobs. So that's the angle here, it appears, is that they want to keep people employed the same way that commercial businesses would.
Right. That's the argument that was made. One of the defenses of this that were put forward by folks who favored this was that if a hurricane rolls through town and it blows off the roof of the church, they could receive federal financial aid, disaster relief aid, like any other business. But again, this sort of step is a dramatic departure from what was allowed before and actually paying salaries. And, you know, it's a lot of money. And, you know, it happened very quickly. This money had to be applied for and was handed out literally within weeks. So there are some questions about, you know, how much any business, not just religious organizations, did or did not need some of the money. And there's been a lot of blowback, as we've read it over the last month or two, about other businesses receiving money that maybe they shouldn't have received. And some similar questions are now being raised about religious organizations. But, you know, you're right. I mean, this is a large number. We don't know exactly how much Catholic organizations receive because the SBA isn't saying it. We know the Diocese of Covington was the single largest recipient in the region among religious groups because they received somewhere between $5 and $10 million. The Archdiocese of Cincinnati had applied for some money, but they later withdrew that application. But dozens and dozens of parishes and churches and Catholic religious organizations in Cincinnati did apply. So it's not really fair to say that the Archdiocese isn't receiving anything because many parishes and schools received a lot of money through this program.
And we're talking with Dan Horn from the Cincinnati Inquirer. And Dan, your reporting did include that those eligible for between $1 million and $2 million included Elder High School, Moeller High School, St. Ursula Academy, Mount Notre Dame High School, and Ursuline. But let's note that this isn't just Catholic organizations. The Solid Rock Church in Monroe, for example, won approval for up to about $350,000, according to your reporting. So there are non-Catholic organizations that benefited from this as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of private institutions, Cincinnati Hills Christian, Summit Country Day, which is a Catholic school but not a part of the Archdiocese, received $2 to $5 million. Solid Rock is interesting because they had basically refused entreaties from the government to close down during the pandemic. They continued to remain open and have people in their church through the entire beginning of the pandemic in the spring. But they did apply also for financial aid and received up to $350,000.
And you found that in all around the region, what was the number for the total as it applies to the religious organizations here? Was it 179?
Yeah, up to $179 million, correct. That includes the Diocese of Covington and then every parish and every Hebrew school and mosque and every organization that we could find with a religious connection. That totals about $179 million. That's the upward end because we only have a range, so we don't know the precise number yet because the SBA has not released that. There's some legal fighting going on to try to get that number released, but right now we don't. We only have the range.
And again, we're talking with Dan Horn of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And Dan, on the Weekly News Review, we usually talk about stories that came out the week of. You had a story, though, last week that I think is relevant to revisit because we are seeing these increased cases of COVID-19 in our region and across the country, starting to cause a lot of problems again. And you explored the idea about the impact of protest and the coronavirus surge in Hamilton County. Can you tell us what you found?
Yeah, as the numbers started to tick up in Hamilton County, we wanted to try to find out what was driving that increase. And so I reached out to the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Health Departments and their contact tracing people to get a sense of, you know, what they're finding when they question people about this. And then when they go back and try to track down who was getting sick around these people and where that occurred. And, you know, what they found was that this initial suspicion that these protests were going to potentially drive a big spike in the virus spread was actually not the case, at least here. You know, the reasons for that could be many. First of all, these protests were outdoors. There was a good bit of mask wearing going on. What we know about the virus is the virus spreads less well when it's outdoors and it disperses more quickly. It doesn't survive long in ultraviolet light. So a lot of these things could explain this, whereas indoor activities such as bars and restaurants and private parties, you know, the virus can linger, it can remain on surfaces, it survives longer in recirculated air and people are in closer proximity. And so they found that most of the spread that they were tracking, at least as of a week ago when I wrote that story, was occurring at these private gatherings or at bars and restaurants. You know, a part of this also could just be volume. You know, these protests were large, but compared to the number of people who go to a bar or a restaurant and have a private party on a Friday or Saturday night, they probably don't compare very favorably. It's a much smaller number. So, you know, I would like to caution that I did get some blowback from people saying I was trying to say that protests aren't dangerous. No one said that. The article certainly didn't say that. I don't know of any epidemiologist who will tell you that gathering in large numbers right now is a great idea. They were only saying that some of these other places were a more likely source of spread than the protests.
Dan Horn is a reporter from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Dan, thank you so much for coming back on the program and sharing your excellent reporting with us. We appreciate it so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Up next, why Northern Kentucky property owners are suing and arguing their delinquent tenants are taking advantage of this pandemic. And a little later on, we're going to look at how Cincinnati is trying to be part of the 2026 World Cup. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As part of the effort to ease economic burdens during this pandemic, evictions were halted. But now, some local property owners are going to court asking to be able to evict tenants that they say are taking advantage of the situation when not paying. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Julia Fair joins us now on the phone. Julia, thank you for coming back on.
Sure. Nice to be here.
And so we saw this play out in Hamilton County a little earlier in this pandemic with some property owners saying that it was time to reopen the eviction court, and they got their way in that. What's happening on the Kentucky side?
Yeah, so on the Kentucky side, on Tuesday, a few landlords went to court to try and resume evictions in Northern Kentucky. That includes the counties of Boone, Kenton, and Campbell. You know, in the lawsuit, the landlords argued that some of their tenants have taken advantage of the pandemic and are refusing to pay rent. They're claiming that they have reached out to the tenants and have tried to work things out, but some tenants have just not gotten back to them. And so these landlords are going to court to try and resume evictions. Lawsuit to watch. This was filed by the same attorney who sued the state to let fans attend the Florence Speedway track, the dirt racing track in Boone County. And so the tenants yet, but if anybody is listening who is a tenant or knows somebody that's a tenant that might be impacted by this lawsuit, please reach out because this is going to be something that's going to continue to develop over the next few weeks.
And that attorney is Chris Wiest, who was also known in the region previously as the former mayor of Fort Mitchell in Kentucky. Who are these property owners? We know that the Greater Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Apartment Association is involved, but then there's three private companies that are involved who own three different properties in question.
Sure. I might butcher how you to pronounce them, but they
that's why I gave you that responsibility.
I'm a print reporter, not radio, but I'll try. Let's see. It's Andural Strategy, Caton Development, and Vail. So those are the three owners that are joining the lawsuit with the Greater Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Apartment Association.
And these do cover all three counties. There's one that's in Wilder, one that's in Park Hills, and then one that's also in Boone County. And they're going after the circuit court clerks, too. Have we heard from them in this manner? I think that the lawsuit specified that they're only being sued because of their official capacity.
Yeah, I have not heard from the clerks yet. That's going to be something to follow as I continue to do, you know, follow-up reporting on it. But, the suit is really going after Beshear's executive order that is suspending evictions. And so there's going to be a little bit of back and forth between, you know, the state regulations and how local officials handle that.
And do we know what might be next in this? Is there any type of schedule for hearing this? As you noted in previous remarks, this attorney has seen some success against the governor in these executive orders.
Mm-hmm. I'm keeping an eye on the lawsuit. I haven't seen that there is a hearing scheduled yet, but when there is a hearing scheduled and any developments, I will be sure to be reporting on it. Lots more to learn out of this.
Well, let's talk about Villa Hills, because some residents there are concerned, and I feel like we've had you on many times where we say Villa Hills residents are concerned about something, and this time it's a toxic chemical that might be stored. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Villa Hills?
Yeah, so a few neighbors in Villa Hills are concerned about a chemical called styrene that a company close to their homes is hoping to store at their facility. Now, styrene is the same chemical that caused a little bit of trouble in Cincinnati in 2005. There was a rail car that was holding this chemical, and it started to leak from a valve, and that caused a few lawsuits. I think the city of Cincinnati got $400,000 in a settlement, and the companies responsible had to pay up to $2 million to families that were impacted by that leak. It's not just in 2005, but earlier this year in May, a styrene leak in India killed at least 11 people. So these residents in Villa Hills are reading about the history connected to this chemical and what happens to when it leaks, and they're concerned, so they're fighting for that to stop it. So this company, it needs permission from the Villa Hills Board of Adjustments to store this chemical. It's part of local law that any company that wants to store a flammable chemical, which styrene is, to get permission from the Board of Adjustments. So that's the kind of government explanation and the residents' concern there.
So what would this look like there? I mean, what type of facility are we mm-hmm. talking about?
Yeah, it's on Route 8. It's right next to the Ohio River. And when you drive past it, it's just these huge, white, big storage tanks. They already store chemicals there. They store liquids like biodiesel, but nothing flammable like styrene.
And so the residents are mostly concerned because of the toxicity of it. And I think that what was there also some concerns about the sense of smell?
Is a really long list of what can happen to the human body when you inhale styrene, and one of them is loss of smell. The lead of the story is one of the neighbors was worried. To express his worry, he said to his neighbors, "What if we can't smell flowers or farts?" And that really, summarized just their most basic concern of what could happen to their bodies if they do inhale this chemical, if there's a leak.
Some people might see some benefit to what you just said, but what do we know would be next about the Board of Adjustment? Is there an upcoming meeting?
Mm-hmm. Not yet. There was supposed to be a meeting for them to consider this earlier this month and pushed back. So there's not a date set yet, but again, I will be sure to get it scheduled.
Okay, and before we let you go, Julia, I know that you're familiar with what Governor Beshear did on Thursday with his executive order as it relates to masks, and it's statewide. Mm-hmm. It goes into effect at 5 o'clock, and goodness knows we saw a lot of comments on social media from a variety of perspectives, but certainly polarized perspectives. But you've got the perspective of an important entity in the fight against COVID-19, and that's the Northern Kentucky Health Department. What did they say about mm-hmm. this mask mandate?
The Northern Kentucky Health Department seemed to be in favor of this mandate. They said that this mandate would save lives and that wearing a mask protects everybody's neighbors here in Northern Kentucky. So the Northern Kentucky Health Department is on board with this mask mandate.
Well, we'll see what happens at 5 o'clock. As you noted, there's more than likely to be some legal battles in this respect as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll follow your reporting to see what happens with that. Julia Fair, the Northern Kentucky reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Julia, thank you for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And now let's talk about soccer with WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Hey, Tana.
Hey, glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And I mean, we're seeing a lot of bad news about sports on Twitter today. I mean, you're talking Big Ten football, not sure what's going on. Is there going to be a season at all? And what's baseball going to be looking like as we get closer to that opening day? But we're talking about soccer with you, and we're talking years away. So we can maybe be a little more comfortable in suggesting that there will be a World Cup in 2026, and Cincinnati wants to be a part of it.
Right. So the United bid won the is going to host the 2026 World Cup. So that means it's going to be hosted by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico jointly. And 10 host cities in the U.S. will be selected from a group of 17 right now. And Cincinnati is in that mix.
Okay. So what does that mean to be in that mix?
Right. So FIFA, which is the governing body of international soccer, held a meeting today, or this week rather, with all of those 17 cities to kind of lay out the process for what happens next. So they've submitted this bid. All of the cities have sort of submitted their plan, and FIFA and US Soccer are going to go around to all of those cities and sort of check it out and see the stadium, see the infrastructure, see what transportation is in play. What's the climate like in the city? What's the status of soccer, the status of women's soccer? He even made a point of pointing out. So now everything is backed up, of course, because of the pandemic. So while they had originally planned to announce the 10 U.S. host cities by spring of 2021, the representative from FIFA said we probably won't even know until maybe the end of this year when they could possibly say which 10 cities are going to win.
Okay, so it's just something.
And,
I was going to say it's something to keep an eye on. And we also know right outside our studios here that there's a new stadium being built, but that particular stadium likely would not be the one that's used.
Right. No, that's not going to be big enough. So the stadium that they're bidding with for Cincinnati is Paul Brown Stadium, which which can hold 67,000 people. However, you got to take out 7,000. Soccer capacity is about 60,000, according to the bid. And, so they're bidding to host a quarterfinal game or something up until the quarterfinals, because it is one of the smaller of the proposed stadiums, but not the smallest. Also, I'll just throw this out there that we definitely win on toilets. Paul Brown Stadium has the most men's and women's toilets of all bidding cities across the three countries.
Oh, wow.
So there's that.
I'm sure that has nothing to do with our Cincinnati delicacies that are served at our sporting events.
Probably not. So I should say that, Cincinnati's not really considered one of the top. They're not a favorite, if you will. But the favorites are, there's about 8 of those. So we could sort of sneak in there. It's got a good central location in the Midwest. So they're really pushing the fact that you're a day's drive or a short flight for a lot of people to get into, the region for games. A lot of people might point out transportation is not maybe one of our highlights. Another thing that Cincinnati could do if they're not awarded the game, part of their bid would be to host a country. So this will be the first tournament that has something like 48 teams, 48 countries coming in, and they all need somewhere to come in about a month or so early and train and acclimate to, U.S. weather and just be in the country. So, the bid includes places like UC Stadium, the new FC Cincinnati Stadium, Xavier's facilities, and all of these places around town that could be used for a country to base themselves out of here.
So is that included with like the active bid, or is that looked at as more of a consolation prize if you don't get to host a match?
I mean, I think it's a consolation prize, right? But it is included in the bid book, which is 530 pages long.
Wow.
So, but that includes all 17 locations that are bidding, that are part of the bid. It is consolation prize. And it also, Cincinnati could be a fan fest city, which means lots of FIFA official viewing locations, giant viewing parties, you know, assuming we can do that in 2026.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to figure out the math to get an idea of what our chances are here. And I just want to make sure that I understand. So there are going to be 16 cities chosen between the three countries, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico?
Right. And Canada and Mexico will get three cities each, and they're only bidding three cities. So I guess you can kind of say that those are set.
Okay.
And then there are 17 cities in the U.S. that are competing, and 10 will be selected.
All right. So seven are going to be cut from that list.
Right. Right. Well, now, there's a bunch of them that are all kind of grouped together on the East Coast. So maybe we can bump some of them out.
Yeah. Right? I'm just quickly going to read the list just to give people an idea of who we're up against. Atlanta, Baltimore, Boston, Dallas, Denver, Houston, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Miami, Nashville, New York, New Jersey, Orlando, Philadelphia, the San Francisco area, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. That's who Cincinnati is up against here. And I'm sure that we will see soccer fans sing Cincinnati's praises in order to do what they can to get that. And I know you're one of those soccer fans, but you're a obviously unbiased reporter, but I know you'll be keeping an eye on this for us.
Yep, I sure will.
And I know you're working on a pretty interesting story today that is related to COVID-19 and also to money, and a very specific type of money that we'll look for online a little bit later and on air as well. Tell us what's going on with coins.
Yeah, there's a shortage of coins.
A shortage
quarters,
of coins.
Nickels, dimes, pennies. Yeah, who knew? So NPR reported this about a month ago. The Federal Reserve issued an order for their reserve banks. And of course, we have the Cleveland Reserve Bank here in Ohio to ration coin inventories. Part of that is because they had to scale back production during the pandemic, you know, to keep their employees safe. And part of that is that people just weren't going out and, you know, bringing that coin into banks or into businesses, into places, you know, like Coinstar that cash those in. So banks are having to limit what they can give out, and that's affecting local businesses. You're seeing a lot of signs in convenience stores and UDFs and places like that asking for people to use credit cards or to, you know, sell their change back. And I talked with one gentleman who owns some car wash locations that are coin operated, and he has resorted to asking friends and family and posting on social media for people to, you know, dig out that coin jar that a lot of people have at home or your piggy bank. And he says he's driving around the area, literally buying coin off of people.
So they're like, there's like this whole underground thing now of trying to get your hands on coins.
Yeah, but there is some good news. I literally just a few hours ago spoke with a spokesman for the Ohio Bankers League, which I didn't even know existed, but is a great resource on this. And he said there is some hope ahead. He had talked to his techs this week at the Federal Reserve, and they've been ramping up production a little bit, and they're expecting things will start getting a little bit easing some of this shortage in the coming weeks, and he expects it to normalize in a month or two.
Okay. So what if, I'm sure there are some people who have hoarded coins. I've got more coins than I need. I just throw them in a sack in the kitchen and I don't know whatever plan to do with them. What if you want to get rid of them? Is there like a particular area where you should go? Is there anyone in particular need of coins? And is there a particular coin that's needed?
Well, I think quarters are probably sort of the big one, but there is a shortage in all of them. You can go to those Coinstar things that you see in the parking lots now, or in the, you know, like in the Kroger or lobby or whatever. Those are going to take a percentage off. The folks at the Ohio Bankers League are encouraging their banks, you know, member banks that sometimes offer those lobby stations again for a fee. They're encouraging them to make those free. So you might check with your bank. I know Fifth Third has in the recent past allowed you to bring in coin. I know you used to have to roll it all yourself. Some locations may not be demanding that you roll it yourself. You can just sort of bring it in. So definitely I would say check with your bank and, you know, Fifth Third and U.S. Bank, the two biggest banking area locations, you know, didn't issue a statement, but everybody needs coin.
Tana Weingartner, here's a penny for those thoughts. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
I want a quarter.
I'm not getting rid of the quarters. I like those too much. They add up more quickly.
Well, you're welcome.
All right. We'll see you soon, I hope. All right. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme song you hear is composed by Rob Fetters. Archives of our program online at WVXU.org. We hope you have a great weekend. We are back here on Monday. I'm Michael Monks.